Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Poison Pen Author Podcast. I'm Patrick, Patrick number two, your science fiction fantasy selector here at the Poison Pen. And I am so excited to introduce Emma Terge, author of Ink Blood, Sister Scribe, one of my most anticipated books of the spring. And Emma, I am so glad that you were able to make it. This is your first published novel. You're definitely not new to writing, but congratulations. How does it feel to know your book is now out there for everybody to buy?
Well, thank you for the congratulations. Thank you for having me. It feels totally great and surreal and anxiety producing. mostly it feels great, you know, totally like my dream is to publish a book. Second to that dream is that people will read that book, which I hope is on the heels of publication. So yeah, it's feeling good.
It's, you know, it's gotten a lot of acclaim by your publisher. And I've got to say that I'm about a quarter of the way into it. That way I don't spoil your book. So for those of you who may have, when we have a brand new novelist out there, we're going to be talking about the book, but there's only so much we want to spoil about the book because we want you to go out and buy it or read it, whether you get it from the Poison Pen, and Emma's got signed copies for us, or from, you know, your local bookstore. So this is really cool. So Emma, you've really been known for your short fiction. You've won the Henry Prize. You've been nominated for World Fantasy Awards. You really got your start in writing short fiction. And for those of you who want to get a flavor for Emma's short fiction, you can actually go onto your website, emmaterge.com.
Yep, you can go to emmaterge.com, emmaemmaemma.com, or fancybitch.com, and they all go to the same place.
Bitch, I love that. Fancy.
I bought that domain name drunk when I was 22.
Good for you. You
can no, sell it later on. I finally have something to do with it, yeah.
And it's really cool. So because we get it's really awesome. You get a great flavor for what you like to write and how you like to write. And you are an author who really likes to kind of twist character and sort of surprise us through your storytelling. Can you talk about a little bit about starting as a short fiction writer, moving into that novel? And I'm really curious, which do you actually prefer writing?
I did get my start as a short fiction writer. And, you know, I've been sort of joking that I'm the opposite of a self-taught writer. I love taking writing classes. I did get my MFA. I went to Clarion West. And I don't know what it's like now, but when I first got my MFA, which was in 2012, like the workshop was really short fiction focused. So when you go to school for writing, oftentimes what you're writing is short fiction. Like you write a short story and then you workshop it in class. And it was rarer, at least where I went to Montana, that anybody would work on a novel. So I kind of got, I think of the short form in some ways still is like my more academic expression of writing. Like I really labor on my short stories. And in some ways I like think more about my short fiction than I have thought about novels in terms of there's just not that much space in a short story. So every word is incredibly important. There's no room to waste space. And for me, that's so fun. It feels like a language jigsaw puzzle. Like every word needs to have its place and be doing like three times the work in order to make everything mean more what you need it to mean. And there's so much more space in a novel. So that alone was really different for me when I started writing novels.
It's really true. And for instance, High in the Clean Blue Air, Path of Water, which is basically a short fiction work that takes place in a fantasy world. And you're doing this entire world building within 6,000 words. And I was just amazed by this piece of fiction that you wrote, because of the fact that you managed to completely build out your characters, you know, the love interest, the librarian. It's just a really wonderful piece of work. And you had to build it out in about 6,000 words. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of that, every word that you chose was very, very precise. And at the same time, I've got to say, it is some of the most beautifully written fiction I have ever read. So you must have a little bit of a poet in you as well.
I did used to write a lot of poetry. I feel caught out. In high school, of course, you know, I have tons of notebooks full of angsty poetry. A lot of it was about, like, I remember writing a poem about the tragedy of the fact that John Lennon died so long before I was born that we would never breathe the same air, you know, just like angsty Beatles fan poetry. Honestly. But I read poetry, like poetry, and I have practiced it a little bit as a grown up.
So one of my all-time favorite college courses was 19th century French poetry. And it was a lot of fun. It was my second degree, to the chagrin of my parents, when I told them, you know, I'd moved from computer science to French language, trying to figure out what I wanted to do.
They're like, oh, mon Dieu, pourquoi?
Exactement. What are you going to do with a French degree? But I mean, in terms of that, it really developed kind of a love of language and a love of poetry and wording. And one of the things that I really noticed within your short stories is the fact that you do something that French poets often do, and that is choose the most meaningful words that you possibly can do use in the English language to, again, explain everything that is going through. So I'm really curious, in terms of world building, in terms of writing, I mean, how long does that take you? Because obviously you said you labored over it. I mean, these must take you an awful lot of time to write.
Some longer than others. The Path of Water, the specific short story that you have mentioned, which I published, I think, last year or the year before on Uncanny Magazine.
Right.
Took me ultimately probably 4 years. I wrote the first like little scene. There's sort of like a little intro scene. And I had that scene and I worked on that one little intro scene without knowing at all what the story was about for like years, like every month and a half or so, I'd go back to it and change like one word. And I couldn't figure out what to do with it. But I'd been sort of like working really hard on the language of the scene, but having no idea what it was about or like what was going on. And then at one point I convened like a group of friends and I had, I think it was a Zoom conversation, actually, it was over the pandemic, where we all showed each other these kinds of snippets that we had been working on and like hashed out what could come of them. And that conversation was really instrumental for me. And so then I went back and I think I wrote the rest of that story in like 3 weeks. But ultimately, it took 4 years.
4 years to come across.
Yeah.
So then what was the origin story of Ink Blood, Sister Scribe? Where did she come from? Where did she evolve from? And has this been something that you've been working on for years? Or is this something that just sort of happened?
It just sort of happened. And also, I think I'd been doing the groundwork sort of without fully realizing it for years. I started writing it in the fall of 2019. Like, and by started writing it, I mean, I was playing around with some of the things that would later actually be in the book and a lot of things that that did not end up in the book. But I started out with magical sisters. That was kind of like what I wanted. And I had some sisters that I was playing with. And that came about because I'm really close to my own sister. I think a lot about sisterhood. I also have 3 stepsisters, so that's 4 sisters in total. It's a lot of sisters. And my younger sister has always begged me to write a fantasy novel about magic sisters. And so I was like, fine, maybe, you know, I'll think about it. And then the pandemic hit and George Floyd was murdered by police like a few blocks from my house. And I got pretty involved that summer with like activist work, and also just like the real world felt so pressing and intense that the thought of writing a fake fantasy world was like nearly impossible for me to conceive of. So I didn't write and I didn't work on the book for the whole summer of 2020. And then when I went back to it, I totally went back to it as an escape. Like,
right.
It was really fun for me to write it. All of 2020, I was working from home. So I was teaching on Zoom. I have housemates, so I wasn't lonely, I think, the way that some other people were lonely, but I wasn't like moving around the world the way that I normally do. And the thing that like got me excited each morning was entering this other world. And so it like started as sort of a serious project. And I, you know, I don't think it's like a frivolous book necessarily, but it certainly was fun for me to write. And it, the fun of it felt so important to keep me going in that moment, really got me through the pandemic.
It is not a frivolous book at all. I think that it's a fantasy novel, but it's literary fantasy. I take it along the lines of, you know, something like Samantha Shannon or Susanna Clarke, where you've kind of got...
Tell me more. My favorite writers.
Well, you bring in the literary, you bring in a lot of... clearly that you have a love of books and you have a love of the English language. And so it feels like a little bit of a kind of that literary movement that fantasy has started to get lately. And what I really appreciate is the fact that for so long, fantasy and science fiction have been kind of placed in this box of kind of less than literature. Mm-hmm. And I think the authors like yourself are putting yourselves out there and saying, no, that fantasy is just as important and it is just as cogent of a form of literary expression as, you know, William Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, or, you know, you can really get out there and delve in deep into the human experience, even if it is within kind of this magical realism or this fantasy mm-hmm. universe. So one of the things that I've got to say, and I'm really curious about, is you've moved in with this sort of literary bent to your novel. I mean, what did you do to kind of bring that in with your sense of language? And mm-hmm. I'm really curious about kind of the development of the story itself. And maybe you can give us a brief introduction and what the story is as well to those who are at home without spoiling too much.
All right. For the viewers at home, those in the cheap seats, it is a novel about two estranged half-sisters who were raised to protect their family's library of magical books. And the story opens, one sister is on a research base as an electrician in Antarctica and has been sort of traveling the world, running her whole life, has not been home for 10 years. And the other sister is at the family home in Vermont, still protecting this magical library. And this is not a spoiler. In the first sentence of the book, their father dies, and he dies while reading one of these magical volumes. And the story actually starts 2 years later. But his death is sort of a catalyst for a whole bunch of events that are set into motion. And meanwhile, there's another third main character, a wealthy young man in a giant house outside of London, who has lived a very privileged life and is beginning to sort of question the origins of his life and his wealth, and wondering if maybe he's in more of a gilded cage. And then, of course, you know, three points of view, slowly they come together and the reader sees how they are connected at the same time that the characters are kind of learning how they're connected. And there's mayhem and adventure and the dog and a cat.
Exactly.
All the important stuff.
I love the fact that you really start things off in Antarctica and you know, you're wondering why your main character, one of your main characters, is there, and it starts to develop, and it really gives you kind of a sense of concern for why she is there, and the reasons for what has brought her to Antarctica of all places. I loved the fact that you immediately give us a sense of things are not going to be comfortable as the story continues on, and your characters are going to I find your book to have sort of a really interesting pace. I myself have been hooked from the very beginning, and I felt like you're just building into this thriller, and then bam, it sort of hits. And I'm really curious in terms of your writing. I mean, did you intend to write kind of a fantasy thriller in one hand and a fantasy literary novel on the other?
Yes, I did, actually. So I read very widely in all genres. Like, no genre is siloed for me. No genre is off limits. I love books in all genres. You know, I wouldn't say I love all genres equally, but I love many books from many genres. And I read a ton of literary fiction. I read a ton of fantasy science fiction. I read thrillers. I like mysteries. I'll read a queer romance here and there. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to write a book that had a lot of genres colliding in it. And I would say, like, the beginning of the book in some ways follows more of a literary, what you might expect from a literary novel, in that it really sets for me, like, the psychological and emotional framework for the characters.
Exactly.
And then sort of more genre elements begin to kick in, like the thriller starts to kick in. There's sort of like a gothic-y kind of New England-y vibe that I was going for in Vermont. And then there's like the British elite mystery magic, you know. And I think that like psychological groundwork is really important for me as a writer to be able to write. You know, I tell my students this sometimes, like, I am a psychologically realist writer at heart, even though the things that might be happening in my fiction are totally fantastical. Like, it's really important for me that the characters themselves and their motivations and the way they think and talk feels like pretty psychologically realistic. I mean, of course, there's like some soapy elements here and there, and it's not, like,
you got to have some fun there, you know.
Yeah, it's not a character.
Right.
I'm not therapizing my characters, but when I say like psychologically realistic, I'm like, well, I want to like know what makes them tick. Why do they do what they do? What do they think about? What do they like to eat?
You take the time to really develop three-dimensional character. And I think that that's part of the joy of your new novel, is that you really get into the character and get to know them. For instance, your main character, and I apologize here, it's Emma, right? No,
that's my name. There's Esther.
Esther.
And you're not the first person to do that. I actually didn't realize I have two sisters in my book, Esther and Joanna.
Esther
and my
Joanna.
Sister's name is Jessie. And it was pointed out to me like long after I wrote the book that it's Esther and Joanna and Emma and Jessie. I was like,
oh my gosh,
I really didn't know I was doing that.
I've got a real job during the daytime, and let me tell you, it was a busy day. So all of a sudden,
no judgment like, for
no
me.
I have they're coming from
students.
But,
and,
no, yeah. But Esther coming in there, you really get the idea of why she's living in Antarctica, and you know, she ends up having this really interesting relationship with her girlfriend Pearl. And I really loved Pearl as a character, and you develop them and their relationship so interestingly within just a matter of a few pages, right? You get to know kind of who they are as characters. And one of the ways that I really loved that you got to know Esther and got to know Pearl's relationship was that when Esther ended up putting up a sign to say, hey, you know, anybody interested in doing jiu-jitsu, MMA, you know, this girl knows how to take care of herself. And then she gets the guy who tries to bully her, and she puts him in his place. And then that just sparks the relationship between her and Pearl. And I thought that was a really cool way of introducing them.
Oh, thank you. That was very fun to write. Because I did, Esther to me is like sort of like the thriller badass character.
Right.
So it's like, so she's got to be able to fight
for multiple reasons. You know,
gotta
right?
Take someone down early.
Well, her life is on the line, literally.
Totally.
And it's not a spoiler in any stretch of the imagination. You let us know right away that, you know, Esther is not in a safe place, even though she thinks she might be.
Yeah.
She wants it. She so desperately wants to be in a safe. She wants normal. She wants normal in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And her relationship with Pearl is her first feeling of normalcy. And,
and of safety, I think, in some ways.
Exactly. It was such a, those scenes just give me goosebumps.
Oh, thank you.
So what sort of research did you do when you were creating this book? What was it that sort of made you delve a little bit deeper? And what were some of the things that really excited you that you wanted to maybe include in the book and maybe you didn't include in the book?
Well, I did do research into Antarctica. If by research you mean I talked to my friends who have been electricians in Antarctica. I asked them a ton of questions, interviewed some people, watched a lot of like video blogs of people on McMurdo Station. So I really, really, really want to go to Antarctica. And the National Science Foundation has a writers and artists grant to go to McMurdo Station. And I wrote part of this book hoping to use it to apply to that grant, but it closed and it hasn't opened back out. So I got a book out of it, but I haven't yet applied for this grant. So anyway, so I researched Antarctica a lot. And I researched book binding and historical forms of books and writing and like cuneiform and early scrolls. And I researched like deities of writing and a lot of that did not make it into the book. I researched a lot into like colonial practices of stealing ancient sacred objects and appropriating them to England and, you know, to museums. Like I read a lot about the British Museum and museums in New York that, you know, all of that kind of
it's all colonialism and it's all stolen, right? And
it's all stolen.
Yeah.
And it's stolen under the auspices of like taking care of it, which there's definitely that happens in my book. Mm-hmm. You know, people, wow. Yeah.
And after political unrest in particular countries, I mean, there really was a lot of the idea of, well, I'm glad we stole these items now because, you know, certain groups would destroy effigies, for instance,
right.
and anything with a human face attached mm-hmm. to it. It didn't match with their religious beliefs, which is sort of scary when you think about, you know, it makes you think about these gray areas of preserving culture a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's also so like paternalistic to think about, like, because that also begs the question, who is deciding then what culture is?
Mm-hmm.
And like, who is the arbiter of human history and who decides what we need to preserve? You know, like, it takes a lot of the choice out of the hands of the people to whom those objects belong to. And yet, give me a day in the Met and I'm like happy as a clam. Like I'm walking around looking at the mummies. I love looking at the gold jewelry that's been like taken from literal graves. I mean, it's complicated. Exactly. In terms of pleasure and interest, it's very complicated.
One of my all-time favorite places is the British Museum. And you know, you go there and you see the entire walls that they've taken down and rebuilt into the museum itself. And it is just fascinating. R.F. Kuang's new book, Babel, was really a wonderful take at looking at colonialism, but using language as a way of stealing and appropriating versus, you know, the actual theft of materials, which I thought was really interesting.
So cool. When I read that book, I was like, oh, this is like a better version of what I was trying to do. Like, no, dang it, R.F. Kuang.
I think it's sort of in a particular zeitgeist. And I think that what is it, do you think, that is why fantasy is sort of moving into this literary realm, and why it's being used to you as kind of a form of social activism.
Yeah.
Because your book does discuss a lot of social issues within your novel. So I'm just sort of curious, it's becoming big.
I think that there's like some complicated answers to that question and answers that I don't know. My take on it, for what it's worth, is that for many years, fantasy was siloed, not only in genre, but in terms of the demographic of people who were reading it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a self-siloing genre, much like romance. You know, romances has long, and women's fiction has long been siloed and been talked about totally removed from like literary fiction. And what is literary fiction is like a whole other question. It's also a genre, you know, literary fiction is a genre too. Let's be clear on that. But it doesn't think of itself as a genre, just like whiteness does not think of itself as a race, you know, like it's all this stuff is complicated. And, but I think that for many years, you know, fantasy fiction was in the realm of the white American or the white Western man. I was laughing, you know, I taught this fantasy fiction class last semester that was so much fun. And one of my students loaned me, his mother had like a 1978, like a very early D&D handbook. And it was amazing. And we were reading it. And the first paragraph is like, D&D counts so many diverse players among its fans. Like we have plumbers, we have lawyers, we have, you know, whatever, farmers, we even have some women.
Exactly.
It was so funny. We were just cracking up. So I think that fantasy is sort of self-siloed in a way. And one of the ways that it's expanding is that it's no longer, you know, when you think of fantasy, when a lot of lay people think of fantasy, like people that don't read a lot of fantasy, you're like, picture fantasy. They picture westernized dragons, knights in armor, you know, castles. They picture like a westernized medievalish Europe,
right?
Which has long been sort of like the default setting for fantasy. And there are fantasy books I love, like I'm not knocking it, but that's the foundations that fantasy was built on. Right. And it's, I mean, it's a shame because like there's so much world out there. And I think that the like more global writers are beginning to write fantasy, and people from like a non-white, non-Western perspective are starting to world build in like non-Western, non-medieval European worlds. And it's just like, it's blown the world of fantasy wide open, literally. And it's also just opened the door for so much more potential to discuss things. And
I think so.
I'm stoked. I mean, I feel like fantasy has never been better. I mean, every day I'm just like adding books aisle and just so excited.
You know, your book's included in some of my favorite books of the year, and I've got to say that one of the things that really excites me is the fact that we've got authors like Travis Baldry, who did Legends and Lattes, which is just this really wonderfully cozy book
about high fantasy, low stakes.
Exactly.
Is there a better tagline? What would make you read a book faster? I don't know.
All it is a female orc who wants to run a coffee shop. I mean, really, it's a wonder. I people look at me when I'm like, think of Lake Wobegon with an orc. You know, it's really what it is. It's
so that too. Just to comment on that really briefly, I think another thing that's changing fantasy is fan fiction and how easy fan fiction is to access online. Like AO3, I think really revolutionized fan fiction. Thank you. AO3. But I think that like fan tropes, you know, my housemate has been playing D&D for 20 years. You know, he's been running a D&D group for literally 20 years. And he loved Legends and Lattes because he was like, it's like what you wonder happens to the orcs after the adventure is over. And I was like, yeah, we call that curtain fic in fandom. Like, I'm like, I've seen this a million times and it's so fun and it's so great. But it's like really, it was totally familiar to me in like the coziest way. But I think that like we're seeing these fan fiction tropes come into the mainstream
100%
more. And I think that that is also really changing what fantasy looks like.
And I think in terms of diversity of character, I mean, we've got so many characters who are, you know, from every walk of life, from every, you know, one of the nice things about fantasy is the fact that you can express ideas of queerness through using characters who are not human, for instance, mm-hmm. to explain something or to explain diversity and the mm-hmm. the need for diversity within certain elements. I mean, we're this month for Pride Month, we're reading Into the Cerulean Sea for our science fiction fantasy group here at the Poison Pen, which
fun.
I do a real quick plug. We Zoom it. So if anybody's watching, you want to join, feel free to email me pat@poisonpen.com. We just send you the Zoom link. It's a lot of fun. We do a lot of, you know, it's a chance to kind of explore some otherness. And, but at the same time, you know, there's nothing wrong too with reading David Eddings, for instance, or John Gwynne, who writes, you know, just this masculine sort of, you know, beat the bad guy, beat the, and it's neat because it really, there's so many different avenues that you can go down.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
I realize it's getting dark. Can you see me okay? I'm gonna move.
See you just fine. Yes.
Okay, good.
So for you, in terms of writing this book, did you plot it out? Did you people are always interested in terms of your writing style. Are you a pantser or a plotter? I guess is the best way to describe it.
Okay. I think it was the writer KJ Charles who used this term in like a blog post that I read. Correct me if I'm wrong, someone, my apologies, put it in, is there a comment section? Put it in the comment section. But I think KJ Charles said, use the term like a circular writer or like a cycler. I am that, which is like, I totally plotted out this book and then probably rewrote my outline like 475 times. I mean, I like did not adhere to what I thought was gonna happen, but I did, I would like write the first chapter. And then I would start from the beginning and rewrite the first chapter and then maybe get halfway through the second chapter and then rewrite the whole first chapter maybe, and then finally get to the end of the second chapter and then start at the beginning. I mean, I have like over a million words of a draft, like I never cut anything, but I have so many drafts of every chapter of this book. It's like horrifying and embarrassing, but, like towards the end, like the first chapter, I think I have like 14 full, completely different drafts. And the last chapter I have one. So like it gets easier
as I go.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. Do you have any novels that are never going to see the light of day that you've written? You're like, oh, yes. This is bad.
I wrote one whole like literary realism novel that my agent, bless her, could not sell. So I wrote a whole book, sent it out, no editors would buy it, nobody wanted it. Thank God. So grateful nobody will read that book. So yes, I wrote a whole book. I've written snippets of tons of other, but like I tried a lot before it worked, I think.
What was the big thing that you learned when this book sold and it went to an editor? What was sort of the big thing that maybe the editor taught you?
I love being edited, I will say. There's nothing for me, there's no, like, I feel really safe when I'm in good editorial hands. And my editor, Jessica Williams, I really loved her editing. So I got she wrote me a whole long editorial letter, and for me, it was really satisfying. Like I felt very understood by that letter. Yeah. I think that the big thing that she taught me is she flagged so many places for me to like flesh out the texture of the world, like, the sensual details of the world, like let the reader see it, taste it, feel it more, slow down here. And then also flagged places where she was like, you need to like speed this up. So sort of like pace and texture, I think she really helped me with.
That's really awesome. I actually have a request from one of the audience members. is there a passage that you like to read or something that you felt was really a strong part of your book, or maybe you just want to introduce us to the first couple pages? Is there anything there that you've got mapped out?
We did talk about maybe me reading something. Do you want me to read the prologue? It's like 2 minutes.
That would be fantastic.
Okay, I will read the prologue.
I think that's a great part of, it really is a great introduction to this entire book, and I think why you need to read this.
Okay, I'm going to read the prologue. Hopefully it's bright enough in here for me to see.
Very okay, yeah.
But you can hear, I think there are, so the prologue is interesting because it really did not change a whole ton from it's the first thing that I wrote, and I sent it to a friend, Leslie Arima, who's another incredible writer. Her short story collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky, I think is an incredible example of like speculative literary fiction, just to plug my pal. But so I sent it to her and she was just like, more, give me more, I want more. And so I was like, I don't have more. And then I just started writing the book. So the prologue is more or less unchanged. But I think that you can hear some of that texture that my editor helped me. So anyway, that's my long intro to a short prologue. Here we go. Abe Calate died in his front yard in late February beneath a sky so pale it seemed infected. There was a wintry wet snowbite to the still air, and the sprawled open pages of the book at his side had grown slightly damp by the time his daughter Joanna came home and found his body lying in the grass by their long dirt driveway. Abe was on his back, eyes half opened to that gray sky, mouth slack and his tongue drying blue, one of his hands with its quick bitten nails draped across his stomach. The other hand was resting on the book, forefinger still pressed to the page as if holding his place. A last smudge of vivid red was slowly fading into the paper, and Abe himself was mushroom white and oddly shriveled. It was an image Joanna already knew she'd have to fight against forever, to keep it from supplanting the 24 years worth of living memories that had, in the space of seconds, become more precious to her than anything else in the world. She didn't make a sound when she saw him, only sank to her knees and began to shake. Later, she would think he'd probably come outside because he'd realized what the book was doing and had been struggling to reach the road before he bled out, either to flag down a passing driver to call an ambulance, or to spare Joanna from having to heave his body into the bed of her truck and take him up their driveway and past the boundaries of their wards. But at the time, she didn't question why he was outside. She only questioned why he had brought a book along with him. She had not yet understood that it was the book itself that had killed him. She only understood that its presence was a rupture in one of his cardinal rules, a rule Joanna herself had not yet dreamed of breaking, though she would eventually. But even more inconceivable than her father letting a book outside the safety of their home was the fact that it was a book Joanna did not recognize. She had spent her entire life caring for their collection and knew every book within it as intimately as one would know a family member. Yet the one lying at her father's side was completely unfamiliar in both appearance and in sound. Their other books hummed like summer bees. This book throbbed like unspent thunder, and when she opened the cover, the handwritten words swam in front of her eyes, rearranging themselves every time a letter nearly became clear. In progress. Unreadable. The note Abe had tucked between the pages was perfectly legible, however, despite the shakiness of the hand. He'd used his left. His right had been fixed in place as the book drank. Joanna, he had written, I'm sorry. Don't let your mother in. Keep this book safe and away from your blood. I love you so much. Tell Esther. It ended there without punctuation. Joanna would never know if he'd meant to write more or if he only wanted her to pass on a final message of love to the daughter he hadn't seen in years. But kneeling there on the cold dirt with the book in her hands, she didn't have the wherewithal to think about any of this yet. She could only stare at Abe's lifeless body, try to breathe, and prepare herself for the next steps.
And I, you know, immediately hooked because you've got that immediate mystery that what happened to Abe and what is this book? And of course, Joanna, you know, needing to uncover some of the mysteries behind it. It's really a cool book. Now, one of the most exciting aspects, I think, of this book and this book launch, Good Morning America has chosen it as their book of the month, which is a huge deal. Huge deal. How did you end up finding out about that?
My editor and agent conference called me at the same time to tell me in the winter at some point. And I said, what? What? What does that mean? Are you kidding?
And you've got to keep it sort of secret and kind of hidden and you know, you can't say anything for a really long time, right? Until the book publishes and you get that nice Good Morning America, you know, seal of approval on the cover itself.
Wow.
It's so this weekend you're actually going to be, we're going to get to see you fully professionally interviewed on Good Morning America. So Saturday morning, right, is when you're going to be doing the big big talk about that. In terms of you know, finding out about it, and then, you know, what did you do? What was your reaction when they told you?
Well, I said what a few times, and I think I said like, oh my God. I probably said like, oh my fucking God, you know, excuse my language. And I said it loudly. And then I, you know, we talked about it, and then I got off the phone and two of my housemates were like standing outside my door being like, what? We heard you like reacting in your room. What is going on? So I did tell my housemates, because I knew they're like a vault, you know, they would never tell anybody. And we were all just like, oh my God, what does that mean? Do I have to go on television? Who's going to put me on TV? Like, do they know what they're getting? I'm like a Minneapolis weirdo. Like, what are they thinking? You know? So we laughed about that for a while. And then I told my sister, who, you know, shrieked. And then I didn't talk about it to anybody for, you know, 4 months.
Yeah. Cause you got to kind of keep it under wraps and, so this means that there's going to be more books I would take. You've got a book deal?
I have a one book deal. So it's a one and done from me. In terms of my book deal, hopefully not, you know.
Exactly. So do you have something that you're working on right now that you're sort of kind of mind flailing around, so to speak, and working on?
I do. I have been like tiptoeing into another project. I'm like sort of, I play things kind of close to the chest until they're like fully done. But I have been sharing 4 keywords. From my new project, if you would like to hear the 4 keywords.
I'd love to hear them.
Okay. Some of them might be familiar to you, given what you've read of mine recently. We'll see. Loon, moon, broom, loom. Those are my keywords.
Well, you know, it's funny because if I'm sort of thinking of what you might be doing, there's a lot of authors who take maybe a short story and expand upon it.
This one might be doing something like that. Who knows?
I know that This Is How You Lose the Time War was one in which it was sort of a, you know, sort of.
I didn't know that. Ugh, I love that book. I have been so just following its blow up on the internet with such joy and delight. I'm not on like Twitter or social media or anything, and I was getting all these texts being like, oh my God, Emma, you'll never believe what's happening.
It's a huge deal. I think that, you know, it's such a lovely book, and you know, Max Gladstone and Amin El-Mohtar, I mean, just really talk about an interesting way to tell a love story. Red Blue Robot, space and time, it's such a cool aspect of it. It sort of, it makes you a little verklempt.
It was so beautiful. I mean, that book is like, it's really like, I felt like it was more like reading a very long poem at times. Like,
it is. It's very poetic. Yeah. And it's one of those exciting things. But I think your book's going to be blowing up as well, which is really kind of cool and really exciting
Pray for me. I'm going to knock on wood again. I'm very superstitious.
We just had Brendan Slocum here at the store, and last year his book was declared a Good Morning America. The Violent Conspiracy was a Good Morning America book. Yeah. You know, it really
have it on Audible. I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited to.
It's worth listening to. Definitely, and he's just a lovely man, and it does sort of change your life, or maybe change your perspective a little bit from writing. In terms of your book getting optioned, you did say that you ended up selling, you were lucky enough that somebody's bought the rights already.
Yeah, somebody bought the TV rights.
That is so cool.
Yeah, which is really cool.
Would you actually want to see it on the screen, or would you be like, you know, keep on, you know?
I feel like very, how do I put this? Like, TV is not my medium. Of course, I watch TV. I'm like a human being. You know, I really like TV. I like TV, like, as a visual medium, like, probably the best, more than movie. I have trouble watching movies, but. So I love TV, but it's not my realm. So I would be very happy for if anybody were to adapt it, like it becomes something else once it becomes a different medium. And I don't feel that proprietary over my work. Like I would be really interested to see what somebody else does with it. Maybe because I'm a big fan of fan fiction and that like sort of sharing culture and like, yeah, play in my world. That's what I would be excited to see. Like,
make one of the characters, your main characters, a side character. And
yeah, totally. Make the Pomeranian a corgi. I mean,
whoever has been trained, right?
Yeah, I trust the people that have been like doing it for a long time. Yeah, so I'm sure I'd watch something and be like, that's not my book at all. But like, of course, it's never going to be my book. It's something totally different. So I would just be like super curious to see what would happen.
Exactly. You can either, you know, they're either going to be very generous and be very precise with your work, or they're going to, you know, do this. If you ever saw the movie Sahara that they took from Clive Cussler's book and they completely rewrote it, and he was very upset. But at the same time, once you let it go, you let it go.
And that's kind of how I feel. And I mean, we'll see, like, who knows, talk to me in like 5 years if they make something and I'm like, oh, why I oughta.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right now I'm like,
why'd they do that with my character? You know, yeah. It completely wasn't like that. You know, but then there's faithful adaptations like Outlander and Jack Harr's The Terminalist, where they kept fairly close to the book too.
Yep.
You know, and I thought that those have been really nice adaptations of some, you know, we're lucky enough that both authors are good friends of the store here. So, so Emma, what's next for you? Are you going to be teaching some writing this summer? Are you going to be just enjoying working on a new piece of fiction? What's kind of your lineup?
Well, I have a very busy summer, mostly just having good times. I was kind of like, I got to pack my summer full to distract myself from having a book out in the world. Like, you know, I didn't know how it would feel. So I'm flying to New York to be on Good Morning America, amazingly and hilariously. And then I'm from Massachusetts. I live in Minnesota, at Minneapolis in particular, love Minneapolis. But I'll visit my family on the East Coast for like 3 weeks. So I'll be in New York for about a week, and then Boston, and Cape Cod, which is where my family lives. And then I come home to Minneapolis for a few weeks, where I'll probably just write and honestly like lie on my back playing Zelda, cause I'm not letting myself bring my Switch. Cause it's
it's a good distraction.
Deep in it right now.
Tears of the Kingdom. You're ready to deepen.
I'm like deep in it. I'm constructing bridges. I'm floating hot air balloons. So I'm not allowed to bring my Switch on vacation, but so I'm going to come home, play my Switch and write for a few weeks. And then I go to the UK for the UK book launch, which I'm super stoked for. And then I'm going to travel around Scotland with a friend. And then I'm flying from Scotland to Turkey to see friends, and then I'm going to go home, and then I'm going to do an artist residency in Maine, and then I'm going to teach all year.
So it sounds like you've got like 6 books from just your adventures this summer. You're going to be doing that. You're going to be.
I'm a big proponent of like living the life to fill the creative well.
Very, very, very Esther of you.
Yes, thank you. You can talk to my sister about that one.
So this is so exciting. So for those of you who want to buy the book, I say buy the book, please, because Emma, this is by far one of the best books I have read this entire year. It probably will stay in my top. It is in my top 10 books of the year, but this is nearing, this is probably number one. Which is really
well. You haven't even finished it. You might hate it by the end and regret saying this publicly.
No, I know my taste, and I am a sucker for literary fantasy. And I think that you've done a great job. Congratulations! You just deserve you deserve this. And of course, you can buy Emma's book through us. You can buy it through the Big Bads. You can buy it through Barnes & Noble. But Emma, also, where else can they find you? Are there any other places that you'd recommend following you and your work?
Well, I do have a newsletter. I don't have any social media, but I have a newsletter that you can sign up for on my website. Again, my website is emmaemmaemma.com, or perhaps more memorably, fancybitch.com or myamateurish.com. I'm sorry if I'm swearing on
No.
Are we allowed to? I don't know anything about this.
We're allowed to share on YouTube.
Okay, good. Okay, yeah. So you can sign up for my newsletter there. It's monthly, so I'll only send it once a month. It's called News and Muse because it has pictures of my stunning cat as well. Exclusive kitty cat content. And that's really the place that you can find me. And if you want a signed copy, a plug for my beloved local bookstore, Moon Palace Books. And the Poison Pen, I believe, will also have.
We'll have copies, them so. In Palace. Did Uncle Edgar's and Uncle Hugo's ever reopen?
They did. Yeah, they just reopened actually across the street from Moon Palace. I need to go in there and say hi. I went to Dream Haven today. For those of you that have never been to Minneapolis, I don't know who's watching. It's a great city for speculative fiction. We have a lot of awesome writers. Like, I went to a picnic and was talking to this lovely woman. Took me a long time to realize it was Patricia C. Reed, who wrote one of my all-time favorite young adult fantasy novels that changed my life when I was 11. And then like Lois McMaster Bujold like walked by with some potato salad or something. And I was like, this is such a cool city. Anyway, we have two great bookstores.
Normal writers are, aren't they, you know?
Yeah, just, you know, at a picnic, swatting flies. But yeah. No, so I went to Dream Haven today, but I have to go to Uncle Edgar's. I haven't been to the new one yet.
Uncle Hugo's unfortunately was burned down in the riots.
And yeah. So that was hard. I wept in the ashes of their store.
I did too. To be honest, I'm a Poison Pen. I've been with a Poison Pen for 20 years, but I occasionally will purchase from Uncle Hugo's because they'll get some stuff signed, and I'm a big science fiction fantasy fan.
Yeah.
And I sort of mourned when they ended up getting burned down in the riots.
Such an amazing store. Yeah. Yeah, they've rebuilt. The dog is still there for those of you that know the dog.
And for those of you who are watching, I mean, independent bookstores, we're a dying breed, support us because we get to do the cool things like interview Emma that a lot of locations don't get the chance to do because it's not agreed to in their corporate structure. So I'm so excited. Emma, thank you so much for spending your evening with us. This has been fun. I hope that, you know, when the next book comes out and as time goes on, you're part of the store family and part of the store history, and we'd love to see you again.
Oh, I'd love to come back. This was a delight. Thank you so much, Patrick. Fantasy Absolutely. Patrick.
Everybody have a great night. Thank you so much, Emma. Congratulations. And we'll see you all soon. And watch Emma Saturday morning on Good Morning America. All right. Have a great evening. Bye, guys.
Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.